Hello, fellow Kentuckians and other friends, and welcome to a new edition of My Old Kentucky Podcast. My name is Robert Connie, and joining me, as always, is Jasmine Smith. Jasmine, how are you today?
I'm doing well, Robert. How are you?
I'm doing really well. Joining us also in the back room is Dan Cannon, not on the show, but
congressional candidate.
Congressional candidate Dan Cannon in Indiana's 9th District is in the house right now. But that's cool. We got to meet him. But today we have a cool show we're lined up for you guys. We are going to talk about Kentucky counties suing painkiller distributors. Jasmine's going to talk to us a lot about that. And I thought we would take a step back and talk about pensions as an issue on the whole. It's a big issue. We've talked about it in piecemeal in several shows as small stories, but I wanted to take a step back and talk about it as its own thing holistically this week. So that's what we're going to talk about. And Jasmine, why don't you go ahead and talk to us about painkillers?
All right. So fiscal courts in several counties in the state have filed a lawsuit in federal court against wholesale distributors of painkillers, claiming that they have inflamed the opioid crisis in Kentucky.
So it's a little important to understand what a fiscal court is,
right? So a fiscal court is not actually a court in the traditional sense. Fiscal courts are actually the governing bodies of a county. So it's really confusing that they're called courts, but that's what they're called in the Kentucky Constitution.
Yeah. So all of our listeners in Louisville and Lexington are like, whoa. And literally everybody else is like, duh. But yeah.
So when you hear like a county judge executive, that is like the governor of a county.
Right. So it's a judge executive because it's a judge in a court. I don't know why it's set up that way, but that's what they're called.
Yep. That's what they're called. But they have filed suit against these distributors of opioids. So 20 counties have filed suit. I'm going to list them off because I think it's important to understand like what regions these are coming from. So maybe Robert will speed me up in the edits here. But
Anderson, Bell, Boyle, Franklin, Fleming, Pendleton, Shelby, Lincoln, Madison, Henry, Nicholas, Garrard, Harlan, Knox, Spencer, Union, Leslie, Whitley, and Carlisle County
have all filed these suits. So if you look at our show notes, I've kind of listed next to each county the region of the state that they come from. So most of these counties are central Kentucky counties with some southeastern and a couple northern and one or two western. So this is mostly central Kentucky counties that are filing these suits and some in southeast Kentucky. So the distributors named in the suit are Amerisource Bergen Drug Company Corporation, Cardinal Health Incorporation, and the McKesson Corp. So two of the three have distribution centers in Louisville, and then one of them has a call center in Radcliffe.
So that's what links them to Kentucky and why they're being sued here?
Yes. Okay. McKesson recently had a civil suit where they agreed to pay $150 million to the federal government for violating a federal drug law. So that's kind of a separate thing, but that's just, you know, an interesting thing about one of the companies that's being sued. So the suit alleges that these distributors have unlawfully sold millions of prescription opioids to these counties that have caused the widespread sale of opioids on the black market that have caused this public health and safety crisis. We've talked about that before on the show, and I think everyone in the state is very familiar with the crisis with opioids that is going on. Other states and cities are filing similar suits. This is happening kind of all over the country. There's a whole lot I could say about these suits and what different courts have ruled. I save that for maybe another day once this suit gets further in the court process, because Robert's got a pretty long segment that he's going to talk about later. So maybe that's another day's show.
Well, let me ask you this question, though. So it says that they're suing them for unlawfully selling these drugs. What would be illegal about the way that they sold them?
We're going to get there.
Oh, okay. All right.
So the suit argues that because of this conduct, addiction drove up the costs for jails, law enforcement, and medical treatment in these counties. They're asking for past and future damages to abate the ongoing public nuisance caused by the opioid epidemic. A senior vice president for one of the distributors spoke on their behalf and stated, quote, "Distributors are logistics companies that arrange for the safe and secure storage, transport, and delivery of medicines from manufacturers to pharmacies, hospitals, long-term care facilities, and others based on prescriptions from licensed physicians. We don't make medicine, market medicine, prescribe it, or dispense them to consumers. Given our role, the idea that distributors are solely responsible for the number of opioid prescriptions written defies common sense and lacks understanding of how the pharmaceutical supply chain actually works and how it's regulated." So that'd be my argument if I was a distributor, right?
And I mean, it's a compelling one because, I mean, you can definitely see how it's like, hey, man, we just do what we're told, which is, you know, the case.
Right. We're not the ones that make the medicines. We don't market them.
Many
defense. We're not the prescribers.
Yeah. Many defense arguments are like, man, I was just doing what I was told. It wasn't my idea. So.
And distributors aren't the only people getting sued. I mean, states are trying to solve this crisis in any way they can, mm-hmm. and states like Kentucky are incurring pretty huge costs to fight this epidemic. It's really hard to come by beds and treatment facilities, so they want to recoup some damages from someone. The Herald Leader reported about this suit, and they talked to Richard Osnes. He's a professor at UK Law who teaches products liability, and I mean that's what this is. This is a products liability case, pretty much. He also teaches property and trust in estates, and he was my trust in estates professor in law school.
Oh man, did you like him? Did you like his class?
I did. He's a very nice guy.
Okay, cool.
And he knows a lot about his subjects too. So he said that these companies have a statutory duty to monitor the distribution of painkillers. So this is where Robert's question comes in.
Okay.
There's a DC Circuit case that came down in June of this year. So the DC Circuit is the most influential appellate court.
Right. Because it's there in the District of Columbia and stuff. That's like, if anything, it has to do with federal law. Mostly it gets sent to that appeals court, right?
Right. And DC Circuit judges, that's kind of a stepping stone for the Supreme Court for them. A lot of your Supreme Court nominees come from the DC Circuit. So it's mm-hmm. a very influential appellate court. Their case in June. So in that case, the DEA was trying to revoke a drug company's registration for failing to investigate or report suspicious orders. The companies were like, the DEA can't do this. And the DC Circuit said, no, it's fine. So they can revoke a company's registration for not investigating and reporting certain orders for prescriptions.
Right. So what this is basically alleging is that there were some people at these distribution channels that are like, huh, this seems kind of weird that this person wants 1,000 or, a million pills, but we're just selling them. So here you go. And that it was their responsibility to investigate why in the world that person wanted that much medicine. Right.
Right. So they actually have a duty to monitor.
Right.
Professor Osnes at UK believes that the counties actually have a really strong case to say that distributors breached their duty and then that breach caused harm to the counties. The counties are arguing, though, that they should be liable for the economic cost of addiction. And Osnes said, well, if you frame it that way, I'm not sure if it's quite as strong of a case. So he's saying it's stronger to say you have a duty to people who use the products to prevent them from becoming addicted. He's saying that there is a duty that they have, and if they can prove that they breached that duty, that they're, that breach in duty caused harm to these counties, then they may win the suit.
Okay.
There are a lot of these suits going on. I'm not sure if they'll be successful. I haven't, read the briefs to see what their arguments are, but this is essentially a tort case. So a tort is a civil wrong. There's, four elements to it. There's duty, breach, causation, and harm.
Right.
And so if they can prove that there was a duty to investigate, that they didn't do it, that some other duty, mm-hmm. it could, any duty that they have as distributors, that they breached it, caused the harm, and harm existed, then they may have a case.
So, and a little bit of the confusion is around what the harm might have actually been and what they're liable for. That's
right.
All right. Interesting stuff. Well, yeah, that sounds like a story that's worthwhile, and we'll be tracking it as it moves its way through the courts. It's a lot of people being involved in here and a big thing that's happening in the state.
And I think that they expect that more counties will file suit, that it could be up to 90 counties in Kentucky that file similar suits.
Right. Yeah, and if you're interested to learn more about the opioid crisis, we have talked about that in a past show, one of our very first ones.
It was a very early show.
Yeah, and also there is a Cincinnati Inquirer piece, which is just incredible, that features a lot of stories about Northern Kentucky and the opioids crisis. That was in their paper a couple of weeks ago. It was free to read when I read it. I think it's still free to read. So if you're interested, you should check that out. Jasmine, all the way back in our second episode, we talked about Kentucky's pensions and the problems. Jasmine, that was more than a year ago. Can you believe that?
It's been a long time.
It's been a long time. So a year has gone by since we last talked about this in a holistic sense. Obviously a lot has happened, and we've talked about a lot that has happened in individual shows.
Right. We talked about the big Facebook chat that Matt Bevin had about the changes that may be made
We talked about when Matt Bevin had his State of the Commonwealth, how he talked about a big hole that was in the budget. We've talked at length about some of the different changes that people have suggested. But we haven't really addressed this as a holistic issue in more than a year. So I thought we should take some time today to talk about what we talked about a year ago and update as everybody as to where we are now. So this is a lot of review. Maybe we should just do a, like a clips show. Like, you know, they used to in those old TV shows, but no.
So this is like the review class before the final.
Yes, that's one way to put it, because there may be a final coming up in the form of a special session.
Okay.
So, okay, Jasmine, first question. What are state pensions? So the state has two major pension programs, the Kentucky Retiree System, which covers the state and county employees, plus the state police.
Which I always call the KSR instead of the KRS.
Yes, it's not KSR, it is KRS. It's not the Kentucky Statutes, it's not Kentucky Sports Radio, it is the Kentucky Retiree System. And then in addition to KRS, there is the TRS, which is the Teachers Retirement System, which, believe it or not, covers teachers. So, since at least the year 2000, Kentucky has really had problems paying the actuarially recommended amount into the pension system, with the exception of the most recent budget. In 2013, Kentucky made a significant change to the structure of their pensions, which made them much more cheaper for people who were hired after 2014. So, there's this thing, there's this concept called a defined benefit pensions. A defined benefit pension is exactly what it sounds like. You define the benefit of what you're going to receive once you retire. There's an opposite of that, which is much more prevalent in the private sector, which is called a defined contribution pension, which they say, okay, as you're working, we're going to contribute something to your pension. We're going to tell you up front what the contribution is and what that ends up being after investments. Who knows? Who can tell? But whatever does come out is yours at the end of the day. You'll hear people to refer to these as DB versus DC. We'll try to stay away from that language. We'll call them defined benefit and defined contribution. So anyways, in 2014, for people hired after 2014, they still have a defined benefit pension, which is when you a much more secure pension, which has been the norm for state workers up until then. But it's a little bit more like a defined contribution pension. There's some like cash hybrid stuff. It's basically like trying to walk the line of still giving people a pension, still giving people the security that they would find in a defined benefit pension, but also taking some of those risks away and out of the system. Okay, so while this issue stands to improve after these changes that were made in 2013, the improvements are in the distant future. So these people who are being hired now, we won't recoup the benefits that we would receive from their retirement until they retire.
Right.
Which is, you know, 30 years from now. Right now, there's still a massive gap between what is owed and what is being paid into the system. So that's the big issue. We are supposed to pay people these pensions, and in order to do that, the legislature is supposed to set aside a certain amount that grows in the markets, and then that money goes into those people's pensions. And we haven't been putting enough money away, so we're having trouble paying these people's pensions. Okay, so Matt Bevin's 2016 budget, which you know was much maligned at the time because of huge spending cuts to universities and other things. This was like right after he was elected. You'll probably remember that. He put most of the saved revenues towards shoring up the pension problems. It was like $1.28 billion over up until the next regular session, which is in 2018. So we're about done paying that $1.2 billion into the system. The Kentucky Center for Economic Policy, KCEP, who we've had several people from there on this show before, they make a big point that a big chunk of the funding for that budget, including the influx in the pension system, is from what they call one-time monies. Can you take a guess as to what one-time monies means, Jasmine?
That's the money that comes from random places in the budget, but it's only a one-time use. Like, you're not getting that annually.
Right, yeah. So, like, one-time is like, hey, there's this big pot of money laying around that nobody's using right now. Let's just take that. You know, recurring monies would be like, we're going to raise taxes by half a percentage point or something like that. That would happen every year. That pot of money is not going to be sitting around every single year.
Right.
So they pulled up all this money and they put it towards the pensions. This one time, we did a good job of funding the pensions this year at the expense of stuff that maybe, you know, needed money. But we aren't going to be able to repeat that on an ongoing basis. And that's what happened in 2016. So the money that we spend on pensions is managed by the KRS board, which we've talked about many times at length in the past as well. They've made news because that's one of the boards that Matt Bevin has reshuffled. Jasmine, you talked to us about that, right?
I did. The board controversy is what put us on the map, Robert.
Do you think so?
I don't know. It was that's just what we talked about in the first episode.
It is what we talked about in the first episode. And yeah, this guy, one of the KRS people, the KRS board chairman, he was like put on, they like had police essentially escort him out.
Yes, they did.
It was pretty wild. So Matt Bevin, he managed to get that whole board reshuffled. That board manages this money using a variety of different strategies, including professionally managed hedge funds that, and other things that have high fees. So the idea behind professionally managed funds is that, you know, you're paying a professional to do a job for you. And their job is to essentially beat the market, because any schlub, you or me or anybody, can just put money into the S&P 500 there won't be many fees associated with that. You can buy the Vanguard Retirement 2050 and they just buy the S&P and your fees are like, you know, less than 0.5% or something. You pay a much higher fee to people to be like, oh no, the S&P, that provides a specific return, but we can really beat that. We can crush the S&P. We're professionals. And that's what the KRS board did, but those people did not beat the market. In the year ending August 22nd, 2016, KRS saw a loss of 0.5%. So that one year there was a loss. That was not what the S&P saw. The S&P had grown about 10% that year. So in that one 365-day period, the S&P, if you just put it into the Vanguard 2050 retirement mutual fund, you would have seen a 10% increase in the amount of money you put in there. KRS saw a loss of 0.5% despite those very high fees. So people are very upset about that. And that was one of the reasons that Matt Bevin gave when he dismissed the board. And maybe one of the reasons that, you know, people were like, hey, this doesn't seem right, but I kind of get it. You know, take that for what you will. Okay, so that's what we talked about the last time. That was about where we got, and people kind of understood that there's a big hole. KRS hadn't done as well as they'd hoped, and we're trying to fill it. During the 2017 State of the Commonwealth Address, which is at the beginning of the year, several months after we started the show, Matt Bevin ramped up his rhetoric about pensions, and he claimed that the state had an $82 billion problem. Now, that stands in great contrast to what had been said was an $18.1 billion problem. That's like, you know, eight times as much.
Right.
It's a huge amount more. And he said, you know, we are going to have to pay $82 billion to fill this hole. And people are like, whoa, how did he come up with that number? So that number is based on returns from investment in 30-year T-notes. Jasmine, if I say 30-year T-notes, do you know what that
is? I have no clue.
Okay, Jasmine. You know, if you put money in the stock market, it goes up, it goes down, it goes all around. It's risky, right? It's mm-hmm. very risky to put your money in the stock market.
Yes.
But 30-year treasury notes are notes issued. That's the government debt. When people talk about the, you know, United States debt, have you ever heard of that before?
Yes.
Okay, so people are always worried about that debt. If you ever wonder how that debt gets funded, like where did all that money go? The treasury sells what they're called treasury notes, and those have basically a guaranteed rate of return. The United States has never defaulted on its debts. It's never missed a bond payment. They go out like clockwork. Even in these very trying fiscal times, we've come kind of close a few times, but the United States has never defaulted on any bonds that they've ever issued, so it's pretty much the most secure investment you can have. And because it's so secure, the United States government can charge a very, very low interest rate. So you're basically guaranteed to receive that interest rate, but it is a very low return on your investment. So Matt Bevin's like, if we buy these very, very secure investments that only return a very, very low amount, we would have to fund an $82 billion hole. That's not a very good way to look at it, because no matter what you're investing in, if you have a massive portfolio like a pension fund, you should invest in a mix of things. And these professionals, even though they're not so good at hedge funds, you know, they're better than the T-notes. You can beat T-notes. You may not be able to beat the S&P, but you can beat T-notes. So that's basically what he's saying, is only investing in the most secure investments would net us an $82 billion hole. That is not the case. But because he said it back in the early 2017, that touched off a round of recriminations about how big the pension problem actually is. And we're kind of in the middle of that now. So the KRS, the Kentucky Retirement System, they had made assumptions before February, which pegged the unfunctioned liability, like I said, at $18.1 billion. And at a meeting in July, which was of Matt Bevin's new board, the group changed their assumptions, which they said were too optimistic. So that's the way that we're setting this up. We have assumptions that we make about how the markets work. We have assumptions that we make about how things are going to come, how much money we're going to have. And that's how we assess how much money we're going to need and how much we haven't funded. So politics aside, this was actually a pretty good move. That it was true that the assumptions of the KRS board previously were far too optimistic. So KRS assumed a range of 6.75 to 7.5 investment return annually. which, you know, that's pretty nice. That's a pretty nice rate of return. And like we said, in that 1 year we talked about, that one 365-day period, they saw a negative 0.5% return. But on average, they earned a little less than 5%. So, Jasmine, when we were talking about the T-notes, you know, I said it was like a 1% return. The KRS returned on average about, you know, five times more than that, even though it hasn't performed incredibly well. The other thing that they assumed was that payroll would increase at 4% annually, but payroll has actually averaged a decrease recently. So the board reduced the assumptions to a 6.25% investment return and a 2% payroll growth, which some say is too high. So let me talk for a second about why payroll growth is important. So part of the pension is that you take a chunk out of the worker's paycheck to pay for it. Do you have that at your work, where you have your retirement that's funded through something that's withheld from your paycheck?
Yes.
Yeah, a lot of people do. Pensions do as well. So when they're making their when they're making their assessments about how much money they're going to have, they're assuming that payroll growth is going to happen in the future, and that there's going to be more and more payroll that they can withdraw from, and that will be money that they make. They assumed a rate of 4% that actually had been closer to 0%. So the assumptions were reduced to 2% payroll growth and, like I said, 6.25% investment growth. And, you know, those are less than averages over the past 10 years. Here's the thing about the past 10 years, though, Jasmine. Do you what was 10 years ago?
The recession.
The Great Recession. So when people are like, oh my gosh, the 10-year average is super low, that's because we went through literally the worst financial period in American history outside of... Well, there's several other...
The Great Depression.
There's several big ones, but in the since the Great Depression...
In a while.
Yeah, in about a century, this is the worst one that we've had. So when people are like, oh, these, even though you knock these down so far, but you know, that's way worse than we've averaged, don't forget that the Great Recession was included in those averages. So, Jasmine, leaving politics out, those changes probably need to be made, but bringing politics back into the discussion, the Bevin administration has been very quick to blame everybody associated with Steve Beshear for this problem. So whenever you hear Bevin administration people talk about the pension problem, they point out that Tim Longmire sat on the pension board. You remember Tim Longmire?
He pled guilty
to fraud.
To fraud.
And all kinds
and
of different
kind of
like corruption stuff. I'm not sure, you know, he's bad. He committed fraud. He was a corrupt person who took kickbacks. That's bad. I don't know if he was a bad person on the pension board. I don't know if just because he was, you know, corrupt, that doesn't
right.
mean
and,
he didn't.
And obviously he was on the board during the Beshear administration. So that's something that Matt Bevin obviously consistently points to.
Yeah. And at one point, Matt Bevin even said that the former KRS chair, Bill, Phelan, should be in jail.
he has said criminally negligent.
Yes.
Many times.
He said criminally negligent. We talked about this on the show at one point, but he also said he should be very directly, and he was like, and you can quote me on this, he should be in prison. They had, and something you should know about this man is that Mr. Thielen had argued publicly about Matt Bevin firing Tommy Elliott, which was the most recent KRS board chair, which we talked about. The cops had to be brought in. So, maybe that was more political than it was about pensions. So, okay, politically, there's some wonky stuff going on there, but leaving politics aside, this was probably a good move to make to change these assumptions. Okay, so after addressing these assumptions, the official estimate grew by about $4 million. So we had 18, we got about 22 now. That's nowhere near $82 billion, by the way, that Matt Bevin originally had said. So we changed some of the assumptions. We got to a current hole of about $22 billion. The impact of the changed assumptions were dramatic and sudden, though. So earlier this month, in September 2017, State Budget Director John Chilton, he wrote a letter to local governments. He told them that the amount that they would need to contribute to CERS, which is the County Employee Retirement System, which is like the local government retirement system. It's part of KRS. There's all kinds of little pensions under KRS. You got the county employees. You have the hazardous employees. You have the police. These are all different pension plans that all roll up to KRS. So the counties are responsible for a portion of the CERS pension, and the formula by which they know how much that they have to pay is based on the assumptions of how much we're going to need moving forward. And because we made these big changes to our assumptions, the amount that is required from these people to pay, it like doubled. It went up by like 50% essentially. So not quite double, but it went up by 50%. Just to point out what this means, And JCPS, which they pay to CERS, JCPS being the Jefferson County Public School System, the amount that they would need to pay for non-teachers, of course, teachers are in TRS, but the amount that they would have to pay for non-teachers who have CERS pensions, it increased from $36.4 million, which is what they had to pay before, to $54.8 million. So for people doing those same jobs in Fayette County, the non-teachers in Fayette County, the number jumped from $10.3 million to $15.5 million. These are huge budget hits.
Right.
That would
Pretty big increase.
You know, some of these small counties out in eastern Kentucky that don't have a lot of money to start with, increasing their budget by, you know, half of the amount of money they were paying into the pension, that's hugely budget-breaking. No one really knows what's going to happen there. That's still an ongoing system. But there has been a move to split out CERS from the rest of the state pension system and make it its own little thing. It's much more well-funded than other pensions. It's, I think, like 60% funded as opposed to like 30%, which is where we are in a hole. Senator Joe Bowen, who is a senator from Owensboro, he filed a bill that had some hearings that would have split CERS from KERS. It had some hearings, but was tabled on a request from the governor. So, you know, people in these counties and people that manage these employees that are going into the pension, they're like, we can't pay this. We have no idea what we're going to do. Okay, so very early in the year, the governor solicited help for determining a way forward on the pension issue. We talked about that, and if you don't remember, Jasmine, we suggested that KSEP submit an application.
Yes.
I don't know if they did that or not. But they didn't get picked. Whatever. This is where the PFM group comes in. They were selected to do this. And they released their proposal in August. Jasmine, you talked about that at length.
We did.
And a former issue. So just reviewing that, their recommendations were to remove all new workers, all new public workers, to a defined contribution system like a 401k, which is what we talked about before, defined benefit. This would be a defined contribution just like in the private sector. Just so you know what this is, like, there's inherent risk in markets. A defined benefit system basically means that the state is carrying the risk. And if they don't get funded enough, you know, the state is like, oh, no, we have a big problem to fix. On a defined contribution system, the risk goes to the employee. So if your portfolio does not increase, you're the only one who's really screwed. The state is like, well, we told you what we were going to give you, and we gave it to you, so there you go. Think about that as you may. I've heard some Republicans frame it as, yes, but, you know, even if the state's carrying the risk, who is paying the money but taxpayers? And so if they're very concerned for taxpayer rights, they're Republicans. So, you know, believe what you want, but, I follow more in the way that, you know, the state is a big entity and can afford to pay these defined benefit pensions and probably should. We should find a way forward with this.
And another criticism of that is why would I work for the state if I'm getting a 401k like I would get in the private sector? Because the thing is, state workers don't always make the most money, don't always get the biggest paycheck, but they're supposed to have these great benefits.
Right. And many Democrats and many liberal folks have pointed out that many states that have moved to a 401k type plan have actually moved back because the costs of maintaining those and closing that or their defined benefit pensions has not been worth it. I believe West Virginia's in that boat. Okay, another one of the recommendations from the PFM group is to raise the retirement age of current and new workers, to remove the ability to put unused sick times into pension benefits, to eliminate any pension benefits for current retirees that resulted from cost of living adjustments granted between 1996 and 2012, which that has proved to be very controversial. The terminology is somewhere between clawback and rollback, and actually nobody's really sure what they're asking them to do. So in some ways they're like, no, you would actually have to pay us back the cost of living adjustments that we gave to you. So we already paid it out. We actually want that money back now.
Oof.
That would be really crazy. The other way, the maybe less crazy, but still pretty wild, is to say, yeah, we increased the amount that you received in these pensions, and now we're just taking that away. You're going to get less than you got before. Which it's kind of hard to take away somebody's benefits. It's difficult to do. Another recommendation from the PFM group is that workers in hazardous jobs wouldn't be able to retire after 25 years, and they have to wait until age 60 if they didn't want their benefits significantly cut. People in hazardous jobs, those are jobs that are very tough on your body. I don't know how I would feel about like a beat cop at 60. Do you see many of those? You work with many of those people, Jasmine?
No.
Yeah, those are cops are people who work in hazardous jobs. You know, I don't know how I feel about a line worker, like a power line worker at age 60. I don't know how I feel about that. That would be tough to swallow for many people. Also, employees could take a buyout offer. And after this was rolled out, the governor gave a stern talking to during a Facebook live chat. You might remember that. Jasmine. We talked about that.
Yeah, threw some shade at teachers. And
yeah, made people really mad. Okay, so all of these moves, this report came out. It was like, here's what we recommend. People freaked out, Jasmine. And this is evidenced by the mass exodus of retirement-eligible workers. So in the month of September, there was a 37% year-over-year increase from the year before. Year-over-year, many, many more people retire than we expected. And if people keep retiring, that exacerbates the big problem. So the issue is we don't have enough workers to fund the retirees that we have. And if people are like, oh, crap, I better retire now, that means they go from one side of the equation to the other. And that means that if they are paying into the system as workers, they would then just be receiving benefits out of it. So that's hugely problematic. So the Senate President Robert Stivers and Speaker Jeff Hoover, who are in the legislature, they nixed the COLA clawback, at least in word. They said, you know, that's a non-starter. But it's still sitting out there on the table. So we'll see what actually happens. Hopefully they keep their word. Jasmine, there is supposed to be a special session at some point this year. And many people expected it to have already had happened. Is that how you say that? I don't know.
To have already happened.
Maybe. Yeah. The governor has been talking about this since this regular session ended. He's like, we're going to have a special session later this year about pensions.
There's supposed to be a special session on taxes, too, which hasn't happened yet.
Well, there either. Was many, many discussions about what was actually going to take place. So the speaker has said that, you know, once legislation is agreed to and written, so once they say, okay, this is what we want to do now, the LRC, you go up and write this up. That could take a month. He said once it's actually agreed to and written, he wants at least a month for members to review it. So if he keeps his word on that, that would put us at November at the very earliest. So that would mean that like they have to agree to something like today. I don't know, very shortly.
Right.
And then the LRC would get it and write it up. The bill would come out. People would discuss it for a month. And then there would be a special session. They would likely, because the Republicans control both houses of Congress and Kentucky, they would pass it and the governor would sign it. That would be very short, but we don't know how long this will take. And the governor seems hell-bent on having a special session. So, you know, if there's a little bit of a immovable object versus an unstoppable force, and who's going to win in this situation? So the speaker's like, we got to have plenty of time. The governor's like, we got to have it done this year. The governor has ultimate power to call a special session, so he will probably win this battle. And I think that, you know, if he has to call it on December 30th, he will do that. I think it'll happen, even if there's no legislation. But you know, who knows? There haven't been any instructions about what the special session would be. And like you just mentioned, Jasmine, a lot of people thought that the special session would cover both the cost and revenue side of the pension system. So they would be like, okay, here's the new structure for pensions. Here's what we're going to do to fix this problem. And here's the revenue that we're going to generate to pay for it. That doesn't seem like how it's going to go. Republicans have said that they want to like figure out how big a hole there will be before we fill it. That's like the quote that they've been giving. So they want to figure out, like, they want to make some big changes to pensions and then maybe later, once they figure it out, make some changes to taxes. Democrats really would prefer to tackle these both at the same time and use this opportunity of fixing pensions to do a lot of work, to develop some new revenue sources for our state, change the way that our taxes are done in this state. And some ideas floated include legalized gambling, legalized marijuana, a sales tax on many services, or just general tax code reform where some of the write-offs that people can take, we take some of those away, replace them with other stuff, because we do have a upside down tax system. We get more tax breaks than we do revenue in. So that's pretty wild. That's something that probably we should fix. But that's where we are, Jasmine. Does that make a lot of sense? Do you feel any more clear about how we're progressing on the pensions issue here in the state of Kentucky?
I do. I feel like now our listeners should know their DBs from their DCs. Oof. We've talked about it a few times now. And, you know, I think for me, it would make sense that you address these tax issues and pension issues at the same time. But it doesn't seem like that is the plan going forward at this point.
I don't know. They're going to have to do something about revenue no matter what. And so, well, maybe they don't. I mean, what's the worst that could happen? We'll go bankrupt. Jasmine, we don't have much in the way of quick hits today, but I did want to recommend three other podcasts to listen to that feature Kentucky politics and government. So the first one is Attica Scott was featured in the most recent episode of, I think it's called the 23%. Which is about women in government. It's from Governing Magazine. I haven't listened to any of these podcasts yet, but I'm going to recommend them without listening to them. You should listen to the Governing Magazine interview with Attica Scott. D. Ray McKesson, do you know who that is?
Yes, I do.
Okay, he's really big on Twitter. He was like one of the first people that was that coined the phrase Black Lives Matter.
Right.
He was big in the Ferguson protests. He has his own podcast on the Crooked Media Empire.
I've been wanting to listen to this, but I haven't yet.
So John Yarmuth was featured on Pod Save the People, which is his podcast. So that's something you should listen to. Haven't listened to that one either, but I'm going to recommend it without listening to it. And the last one is if you have not had your fill of Pension Talk, on this episode, Kentucky Tonight, who has both a television show, which you can watch. They have recordings on KET. And if you would like, you can listen to them in a podcast format. They have an hour-long show about public pensions. That was their most recent episode. They talked to two state senators, including my state senator, Morgan McGarvey, and two state representatives, one Democrat, one Republican from each house, including Senator Joe Bowen, who we talked about from Owensboro in this episode at one point. You can listen to them talk a lot about how pension reform is working from people in the government. So I listened to that. I did listen to this one. It was good. It was good. I would recommend listening to it. All right, Jasmine, long show. But we talked about a lot.
We did.
We got introduced to a brand new pension or a brand new opioid story, and we reset pensions. I feel like we accomplished a lot today. Jasmine, how can people get a hold of us?
They can find us on Twitter at @myoldkypod. We have a Facebook page that you can like. We post our show notes on Medium, and you can find our podcast on the podcasting app of your choice.
All right, everybody. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next week.